Welcome to Radio Aldi, brought to you by Bailey Gifford.
I'm Charlotte Metcalf, and my guest today is the eminent historian Anthony Beaver, best known for his popular works on the Second World War, the Spanish Civil War, and Russia. His books have been translated into 37 languages with over 9 million sold. He's been awarded numerous distinguished prizes, medals, and honorary degrees, both here and abroad, and been elected as an honorary fellow to several universities. In 2017, he was knighted for services in support of the Armed Forces Professional Development. Anthony Beaver, a very warm welcome to Radio Aldi.
Very good to be with you, Charlotte. Thank you.
Well, it's very exciting to have you on, as you've just released your latest book, Rasputin and the Downfall of the Romanovs, which I hugely enjoyed. There have been so many books on Rasputin, so what was it that made you want to add to them? And can you tell our listeners what your research drew up that perhaps we hadn't known before?
Well, Rasputin has always fascinated me because of this flagrant contradiction in the great man theory of history. I mean, here we have a virtually illiterate peasant who has more effect on the course of history than almost any individual that one can imagine. As Kerensky, the leader of the provisional government after the revolution of 1917, said, without Rasputin, there would have been no Lenin. And in many ways, this particular book is a prequel to my previous one, which was Russia, Revolution and Civil War. And I was always intrigued by the way that Rasputin arrived at a time, particularly that sort of fin de siècle corruption and I think psychological disturbance, which one always seems to get around the turn of centuries, in Petersburg, where people were longing for a shaman, a spiritual leader of some form. And here we see this other, I think, not necessarily a contradiction in this case, but we see this other major effect, which is that because everybody thought that Rasputin was sleeping with the empress, with the Tsar's wife, and even the rumors said the daughters, the Tsar was seen as a cuckold. And in a patriarchal society like Russia, that is where all respect for him started to disappear. So when he came to February 1917, there was hardly a single officer of the Imperial Lifeguard Regiments or anything who would draw their sword in defense of the Tsar and the Tsarist system. So it's a great lesson for today as well, of the effect of rumor, of totally false news, whatever you want to call it.
One of the most intriguing things, sometimes I wonder if you thought this, he was a bit of a scapegoat and receptacle for the rage felt against the Tsar's weakness. Because what you were really good about with your detail of how loyalty to the Tsar was so ingrained in the Russian cultural psyche. So for, as you say, all the officers to sort of turn against him was such a big deal.
I think that is true indeed. But, the attitudes have been changing already, partly because Nicholas had all that terrible failing of, by being weak, he was obstinate and wouldn't listen. And it was the despair of all his ministers that he wouldn't listen. He would just start looking out of the window if it was something that he disagreed with. He would just light a cigarette and turn away and look out of the window. And basically, he was not listening at all. And of course, this gave the opportunity to the Empress, when she started to encourage him to take over as commander-in-chief during the First World War in 1915, and with Rasputin, to start appointing all the ministers, even prime ministers, governors, everything. And as a result, it became known as, it was a farce, it became known as a ministerial leapfrog. And there she was, and I mean, she was unbalanced, there's no doubt about it, because she was telling the Tsar that he had to use Rasputin's comb to comb his hair to give him courage before he had a meeting with the ministers, because she was so afraid, I think, of his weakness that he would be won over by the politicians rather than just listening to her and Rasputin. And that is why they not only referred to Rasputin as our friend, every single minister had to be chosen, according to her and Rasputin, on the basis that they actually supported them, Rasputin and the Empress, rather than any other quality or ability in doing the job.
Two big questions. One is, did you uncover any new research about him? Because what's intriguing about Rasputin is we know very little about his inner life, don't we? Because he had no diaries or anything, did he?
Well, interestingly, what we did uncover is in the Russian archives, there is a diary of Rasputin.
Gosh.
Now, no, but hang on a second. It's been in the Russian archives since just after the Civil War in 1921. Now, the great experts there and all the rest of it quite understandably think it's a fake. But it's a very interesting fake because there's obviously material in there which is absolutely true, which has not appeared elsewhere. And one of our friends and neighbours down here in Kent is Princess Olga Romanov. And her grandmother was the Tsar's sister. Her aunt was the beautiful Grand Duchess Irena. Olga confirmed to me, and this is what I really needed, that she'd heard within the family the whole story of her great-grandmother's dream. Now, the great-grandmother was the Dowager Empress, who was, when she was pregnant with Nicholas, had this devastating dream that when they were going to be, she and Alexander III, the father of Nicholas, were walking up a mountain, and suddenly this baby appeared in her arms. And she said, "What's this?" And he said, "Well, you know, that's your future son. That's the future Tsar." And the baby jumps out of her arms, scrambles up the mountain ahead of her. And at the top of the mountain, there is this peasant with an axe who chops the baby's head off. And she is completely traumatized by this. When 38 years later, she hears that her son and daughter-in-law have fallen and become completely besotted with a Siberian peasant called Rasputin, she's the one who leads the opposition against, within the family, within the Romanov dynasty, against Rasputin. And although there are obvious bits in this so-called diary, this is in the State Archive of the Russian Federation. And I mean, I was incredibly lucky. We were able to still, thanks to a certain, shall we say, network of support in Moscow, still get at all the stuff even during the Ukraine war.
Do you think his apparent ability to alleviate the suffering of the Tsarevich, and do you think that was coincidental, or do you think that and his apparent ability to look into the future and predict things was real or coincidental?
Well, he was no clairvoyant, because otherwise he'd have predicted his own murder by Prince Yusupov when he was accompanying him to the party. I mean, I think he sensed he was going to get murdered, but not on that particular occasion. No, the whole issue of his ability to cure, particularly to cure Alexei the heir to the throne, is a fascinating one.
Mm.
I think that he had a combination of two things. One was he had an extraordinary voice was able to calm, and in many cases, when he was present with the Tsarevich, there was such a calming effect from his voice and his presence that could bring down the level of anxiety and actually then reduce the blood pressure, which did make a huge difference in terms of releasing the pain that the child was in. On the other hand, there were occasions, and the worst of all was in 1911 at Spala in Poland, when they thought the boy really was dying. And there, Rasputin was not physically present. Now, the doctors thought it's either coincidence, he just happened to have spoken to the Empress at the right moment, or there were theories, which I think were rubbish, was that he was getting the Anna Virubova, the Empress's great friend and his great friend, to pass drugs or some sort of medicine to the child. Well, I think that's totally untrue. But what I do know, and this actually is from personal experience, is I had a very, very bad back at one particular point. And I was advised by a friend to see this man who had studied in Japan, and he simply passed his hands over my back without touching at any particular point. And it was astonishing the effect that that had. So all I'm saying is there are areas which we still don't yet know about cures, about the ability, about healing, which are there. So it doesn't mean necessarily that Rasputin was a charlatan, and in many ways he was a bit of a charlatan in lots of ways, particularly, shall we say, in his seduction technique towards women. Total charlatan. I mean, in fact, actually, he was an appalling hypocrite, going on about how much he loved women, but he was actually a rapist, yes, in many cases. But from the point of view of the healing process, I think there was probably something which was quite genuine, and it wasn't just psychosomatic.
I mean, how do you know he had this, is it hearsay that he had this wonderful voice?
Oh, yes. There's no doubt about the voice. There was something about the voice. There's no doubt about that. There's something mesmerizing about the eyes,
yes,
as well. I thought they were terrifying and scary. I mean, you know, if one looks at the photographs and so forth. And so did a lot of the women. But they found these mixture of, if you like, fear, excitement, reassurance. The astonishing thing, the most fascinating thing about Rasputin was his ability to change in a second. So, I mean, from one moment, it could be deep spirituality could turn to lust. And in almost another moment, he'll be down on his knees praying for repentance. I think the Russian mixture and self-contradictions, which actually makes him sort of so Russian in that way and why he's such a fascinating character. I mean, as the great Fyodor Tyutchev, the great poet of the 19th century, said, you know, Russia cannot be understood with the mind alone. And that, I think, is absolutely true. And that's absolutely true of Rasputin himself.
So you personally, do you have any sympathy for him, or is he just a sort of out-and-out monster?
I mean, he was a monster in many ways. That's certainly true. And he was a monster in the way that he treated women. That is certainly true, even though I'm afraid most of them sort of became completely besotted with him. But, I mean, the spirituality was genuine. But I mean, he was somebody who could, as I say, would switch from one extreme to another. He was corrupt, but he also gave away all his money. Every contradiction you can imagine almost was there within his own personality, within his own character, rather like Russia itself.
You were talking just now about your you know, access to the archives and everything. But I really want to ask you about that, because a lot of our listeners will be aware of the controversy that surrounded, you know, two of your books, particularly Stalingrad and Berlin, when the Russians were not at all happy with
no, Stalingrad was fine. They didn't, I mean, even the Stalingrad veterans and all the rest of it, they all supported the book. It was a Berlin book which caused all the trouble. The fact of the mass rapes of 1945 in Poland, in Hungary, and above all in Germany, and the fact that it came from their own archives, The problem is why they were so angry was because, of course, for them, the victory of 1945 is sacred. And as the Russian ambassador in London warned me at the time, he said, "You don't understand." He said, "You know, the victory is sacred. You cannot tell the present generation of Russians that their grandparents, their grandfathers were all rapists." So that's why I've always been condemned as the chief slanderer of the Red Army.
So how did you manage to have this amazing access to the archives and...
I can't go back. I'm liable to 5 years imprisonment. No, I can't possibly go back. I'm sorry, but I'm not going to go into details. I'm afraid people are slightly, shall we say, at risk if I... I'm not going to go into details about the actual research in that sense.
Can we just go back a bit? Because I'm really intrigued about your history. Because you originally were from a very young age, you were in the army as a cadet. And studied under the historian John Keegan. And then at 24, you left the army to write. And your first book was not historical at all, it was a novel. Tell us how all that happened, from army to writing a novel. It's quite...
Okay, well, when I was small, I had Perthes disease as a child. I was on crutches for 3 years, or just under 3 years. And as a result, bullied at school. And that's when I decided I wanted to join the army, basically, you know, to prove myself because of a physical inferiority complex. But it was really after, and actually I had a wonderful time. I loved my regiment, the 11th Hussars. They were a fantastic lot. But after 5 years, I suddenly started to realize when I wrote that first novel, which thank God was never published, it was the worst form of sort of, you know, autobiographical juvenilia. I realized that actually the real reasons for having joined the army were not what I persuaded myself at the time. And that's when I decided my mother's side of the family had all been writers. And actually, I was the sixth generation of the family published by John Murray. But actually, it was silly in some ways because... there is no writing DNA. I mean, you know, there was no justification just because the rest of the family or her family or my mother's family had all been writers, why I should. I mean, in those days, there weren't any writing courses. And the only way of actually learning how to write was to be published yourself. And that's why I started off by writing one or two political thrillers. And I had a brilliant editor. And I would come out feeling totally humiliated after two-hour meetings with her. But I learned more from her than I could have learned from any writing course at all.
But you did have four novels published, did you not?
Yes, it was altogether four. Mm. There's only one I was reasonably proud of. No, but the others served their purpose. I mean, you know, I was very grateful to them for having used that as the way of learning how to write. Publishers were saying, well, you may not be a novelist or whatever, But you obviously can write, and with your military experience, this pushed me in the direction of writing about military affairs. So following the great Professor Sir Michael Howard, I refused to accept the title of being a military historian, but as Michael Howard quite rightly said, we should be historians of war, because obviously we should be covering everything about the suffering of women and children and civilians, rather than just the movement of troops on the battlefield. So that is why, you know, everybody, whether Max Hastings, me and other friends, you know, we are historians of war, not military historians.
How do you go about researching ordinary people's lives? Because they're very, you know, more often than not, they're not documented at all.
Well, you can only do it through contemporary sources. I mean, it's vital that one can find material, whether diaries, letters. Diaries, of course, are usually the best of all. And you can get a huge amount of sort of personal detail in that particular way.
When you left the army to become a writer, you left a very regimented life for one of that involved a lot of solitude and a lot of self-discipline. I just wonder how you made that transition.
I do remember the problems after leaving the army where suddenly you had to acquire a self-discipline because you just relied on an external discipline. You had to make sure you got yourself out of bed in the morning,
Yes.
in that way. It wasn't quite that bad, but even so, obviously you have to just get on with life. And I don't know, it was, I suppose, a gradual process.
Your wife, Artemis Cooper, is also a writer. Does that help?
Oh,
Does she?
God, yes, hugely, hugely. I mean, all of her family were writers. In fact, one of the one of my unwise things early on, having married also into another family of writers, but wonderful writers. I mean, Duff Cooper, one of the greatest writers, I think, of English prose. Her grandmother, Diana Cooper, one of the most brilliant and original writers, and of course her father, John Julius Norwich. So I asked John Julius if he'd have a look at one manuscript. And there was an awful, I hadn't realized was this terrible purple passage which I had written. John Julius just wrote in the margin, "This temptation should be firmly resisted." So, one learnt a lot. He was a brilliant editor in that way. And Artemis and I, we edit each other's work the whole time. I mean, if it's an important email I have to send off or whatever, I'll get her to look it over first. And ditto. So, no, it makes a huge difference.
I'm sure you won't mind, given we're amongst oldies, that you're going to be 80 this year and
I
showing,
know, I know. Yes.
but showing absolutely zero signs of slowing down, and you're off to Germany. So what
Well,
are you?
no, I am, of course, I'm going to say that. I mean, John Julius did his last book at 89. There's no way I'm going to try and challenge that. I mean, apart from anything else, I'm on chemo and I've got cancer. So I'll be doing about another, after Rasputin, there'll be two more books, and I'm not going to tell you what they are. And that's it. So, but I mean, one can just keep going until either you lose your readers or your marbles.
I'm sorry to hear you've got cancer. I didn't know that.
Oh yeah, well that's all right. I've been incredibly lucky. I mean, considering I used to smoke 20 gitanes a day, I've only got multiple myeloma, which is bone and marrow, which it's the chemo which knocks you sideways. So I've got very little to complain about in comparison to some friends who've really have suffered.
So I suppose as a last question, with so many horrific wars going on at the moment, are you tempted to write something about a current war,
It's
so
almost
Palestine?
impossible to write about current wars, I think, at the moment. Ever since the change, I think it came really very much with the Iraq War, where the records are no longer on paper. Too much is just electronically, emails. Perfectly well, you've got no idea what's been suppressed, what's been recorded, what's been kept. That's one aspect. What I do find, and I think that one's duty, and this is following very much in the footsteps of the great Vasily Grossman, who, after writing about Treblinka in 1945, he had a nervous breakdown, but he said, "It is the duty of the writer to write it, and it is the civilian duty of the reader to read it." Now, the trouble is, we're so far away from the horrors of the Second World War. We're seeing people like Nick Fuentes in America, making jokes about the Holocaust and Hitler and all the rest of it, that it is, I think, essential for writers in a position, say, like mine, to re-emphasize the sheer horrors of war. Now, I've been attacked, like, well, Max and Hastings and I were both attacked by sort of Neil Ferguson for writing the pornography of war. Well, it's not the pornography of war in the sense that it is a warning of what war is really like. So there is no illusion amongst the younger generation that anything like the past or the 1930s, 1940s under Nazism or whatever could be either funny or attractive or glamorous. And I think from that point of view, we've got a lot of work to do.
I think that there's been quite a acceleration of Holocaust denial, it seems, and
Yes.
on the basis that there's no evidence for it, but nowadays, as exactly as you were saying at the beginning and just now, the problem is there's so much disinformation. It's very, you know, future historians are not going to know where to start.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree more. And actually, again, well, just to finish again with Rasputin, I mean, you know, it was the disinformation, the rumours and all the rest of it, which actually historians in the past have always dismissed or underestimated. They've always worked from official papers rather than from the diaries, which actually give you an idea of the fears and the misinformation which surrounds people's lives. You know, it is literally constant disinformation of the worst order. Yeah.
So how do you predict the future of writing history?
I think it's going to be very, very difficult. I think it's going to be very hard for historians in the future, simply because of the sources. As I was saying, you know, how can you know what has been suppressed and what is? In the old days, it was a very straightforward system. After a campaign or a war or whatever, the papers were boxed up and then they were weeded 25 years later, or the 30-year rule or whatever. And all of that worked reasonably well. But actually, even the Freedom for Information Act was counterproductive in its sense, because it meant that anybody who was worried about particular events was much more likely to suppress the material, make sure that the papers never got back to the archives. And I'm afraid, as a result, we're never going to have the full account left. So, I mean, this is the thing where freedom of information actually becomes a form of censorship in its own bizarre, paradoxical way.
Do you think that's preferable to the current electronic recording of everything, which is so easy to tamper with?
Well, that's what I'm saying, is that people will not record on paper what they can record in emails, which can be deleted so easily.
Yes, it's been an absolute privilege to talk to you. I wish we had longer, because all these issues you're raising are so fascinating. But thank you so much for being on Radio Oldie.
Very good to see you, Charlotte. Thanks so much. All the best. Bye.
You've been listening to me, Charlotte Metcalf, in conversation with Anthony Beaver. If you've enjoyed listening to us and would like to hear more like this, please go to www.theoldie.co.uk, where you'll also be able to subscribe to the magazine. Meanwhile, my very warm thanks again to you, Anthony Beaver, to Bailey Gifford for sponsoring us, and to you for listening. Goodbye. You've been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter OLD TRIAL as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter OLD TRIAL.